Let's hope.
Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the second hearing of the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is February 7th, 2017, and welcome, everyone. And we're going to start off with a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill. And I want to remind people here, many of you are new, that when we have a committee bill, your voting in favor of hearing it as a committee bill does not indicate your support for the bill itself. It just indicates that you agree that we should hear the concept. So, Vice Chair Stern.
All right. Chair Kinnegar, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill. LC 1386, dated February 2nd, 2017.
Rep. Stark moves that LC 1386 be introduced as a committee bill. Also, as a reminder, it is in OLIS. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to introducing it as a committee bill? Okay. Seeing no objection, the motion passes. Then the measure is introduced as a committee bill. Okay, now we are going to open a very full informational hearing on housing. Really delighted that you can all be here. Thank you, Director Salazar, for coming back and resuming where you left off. And if you'd like to... informational session. Close the work session. Thank you, Vice Chair. And open the informational hearing. Director Salazar, and you have Megan Bolton with you. Thank you. Keeping on track. That's good. You got your own gavel now.
Good morning, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Stark, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you for having me back this morning. Last week, I began my presentation with an overall overview of our agency and some of our key programs. Today, we are going to share some data with you related to the state's housing needs, and then we'll wrap up our presentation by telling you some of the good work that we're doing to address that need. When I came before the committee last week, I mentioned that the agency is embarking on an ambitious statewide housing plan as mandated by statute. We are trying to get a handle on the state's housing and community services needs, including regional snapshots. Today, our research analyst, Megan Bolton, will share some of that data with you so that you can get a taste of what we're working on. And then again, we'll shift gears and talk about some of the good work that we're doing to address those housing needs. So I'd like to introduce our senior research analyst, Megan Bolton.
Thank you. Should I go through?
So, Megan?
Yes.
For the record, please introduce yourself as well.
Absolutely. So, good morning, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Stark, and committee members. For the record, my name is Megan Bolton, and I'm the Senior Research Analyst at Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thanks for having me this morning. So as Margaret just mentioned, we've been working on a statewide market analysis and needs assessment for Oregon. And this is just kind of a list of all the primary data sources that we use for that. A lot of the data comes from the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, decennial censuses to do some comparisons. We are also able to work with a lot of local realtors to get some RMLS data on home sales and inventory, and some internal data as well as the others listed here. So it's kind of split into these two sections, as I said, a market analysis and a housing needs assessment. The market analysis really goes through population changes, demographic changes, the housing stock itself and how that's changing, housing production, vacancy rates, home sales, rents, those types of data points. And then the needs assessment kind of looks more at the people and what's happening, what challenges people are facing in accessing housing right now. So looking a little bit at the economy and household income and poverty and homelessness, and then really trying to get into what does the shortage of affordable units mean for people, what kind of cost burdens are they experiencing, and what are some of the needs of people with special needs as well. We get into some of that information. So I'm just going to give a brief overview of some of what's in here. It's not completely comprehensive, but we will be doing, and I'll note we're doing this at the state level, and then we also, because issues vary greatly from place to place. We have created these regional profiles to really dig a little deeper in, and also actually have the ability to look at some county-specific information as well. So to start off, we know that Oregon is a very quickly growing state. The population is now over 4 million, and it was the 10th fastest growing state from 2014 to 2015, and the top state in kind of in migration. So lots of people are coming to Oregon. The population is aging. About 16% of the population is over age 65, expected to rise to about 18.5% by 2020. And we know that the population is growing more diverse. The rate of growth among people of color was 63% from 2000 to 2014, compared to a growth rate of just 7% among the white population in that time period. In terms of the housing market, home ownership rates, we know, have been declining since the Great Recession, really. The lines here, the blue line is the US, green is Oregon. So certainly since about 2009, home ownership rates in Oregon have been declining pretty rapidly. And this is, we know, putting some extra pressure on the rental market right now. We also know that home ownership rates vary pretty significantly by race. So as you can see here, the home ownership rate for the white population is 66% compared to, as an example, 37% among African Americans. So there's a big gap here in home ownership rates by race and ethnicity. And there are, for two groups, home ownership rates did increase slightly, but that's for Asian Americans and Hispanic population. But for all other racial and ethnic groups, the home ownership rate declined. So homeownership rates are declining, and new residential housing permits really took a big dip from about 2005 down to 2010, where they hit some lows for all unit types. Blue up top is total units, and then we've got the red is single units. The purple is five or more. So we're seeing these start to increase again. But I will note that five or more, the purple line, which looks like it's almost meeting the single family line, that's a lot of that is due to Portland specifically. So when we get to the regional profiles, I'll kind of show how it looks region by region. In a lot of regions, it's really still pretty stagnant. So this has really created to a low inventory of housing of all types. Coupled with that in migration is really putting a squeeze on the housing markets, specifically the rental market. And so we see really low vacancy rates. And in fact, Oregon has had one of the top five lowest rental vacancy rates in the country for the past couple of years, and it's a little bit below 4%. So we know, again, that those numbers vary quite significantly by region, which we'll look at the regional profiles. But this means that both home prices and rents are on the increase, right? So this is the data we were able to get from some of the MLS administrators about home annual median home sales prices from 2007 to 2015. So it's this U-shape where prices are now coming back up from where they were at lows, and kind of in some cases just getting to back where they were. For rents, I will note we don't have a great national kind of data set on rents. This data comes from HUD's Fair Market Rents, which kind of uses American Community Survey data and does some projections forward. Again, our regional profiles will try to pull in more local data to really get a more realistic picture of rents, but this kind of gives a little bit of an indication of what's happening. The big spike there in Portland, too, I need to note, is really due to kind of a methodological error. That people in Portland recognized that these were not true to reality, so did a different methodology, and the rents were set higher. But we know that rents are increasing across the state. So that's a little bit about the market and what's happening. And then, so kind of to switch to the other side a little bit and talk about households and families, we know that median household income even before 2011 on this map, was really either declining or stagnant for a number of years since the recession. And only in this past data that you can see from 2014 to 2015 have we seen an increase. And we know Oregon's economy is strong right now, and so there are some gains there, but it's important to note that there are still over 600, close to 600,000 Oregonians living in poverty, and this isn't reaching everyone, kind of these recent income gains. In terms of homelessness, the data here is from the 2015 point in time count, because that's the last time until this January that we did both a full sheltered and unsheltered count. So I wanted to include the 2015 data here. There were about 13,000, a little over 13,000 homeless people in Oregon. And 44% were sheltered, 56% were unsheltered. So Oregon has one of the top five highest percentages of unsheltered homeless people in the country, and this is certainly a concern of ours that we want to address. So incomes are stagnant, rental market's tight.
Yes.
Excuse me. To go back to the previous
Absolutely.
Slide.
Absolutely. I can do that.
Okay. Thank you. The one question I have is, we know that this is a problem statewide.
Yep.
And frequently we focus on the urban areas, but we know that the rural areas also struggle with this. Do you have a breakdown of that?
Yes,
okay.
We do.
Yeah, so we have that as in a breakdown. And you're absolutely right. And I think I should note that the rural balance of state continuum of care has one of the highest rates of all kind of rural continuums of care as well in the country. So that's absolutely correct. And we have that data at the county level and at the regional level.
Okay. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So what this slide shows is kind of a little bit of how the struggle that low-income Oregonians face in finding units that are affordable to them. So the side over here is households by income category, and this side over here is units by their affordability. So this means that there are about 130,000 or so extremely low-income households, so at 30% of median family income or below, which is around 19,000. And there are only 56,000 units affordable to them, so meaning that they wouldn't spend more than 30% of their income on housing costs, and so that's a rent of about $470. And then if you go up to the 50% threshold, so the red is 50% of median family income or below, which is around $31,000. There's more units that are affordable to them at about rents of $783. But these people are competing for a really small number of units, and they're competing with not just each other, but even some of the higher income households are actually living in those units. So it's a real struggle, right, for people to find affordable housing. And in fact, there are really, when you kind of look at both the affordability and availability, when you take into account those people who might be higher income people living in those houses, there are only 22 affordable and available units for every 100 extremely low income renter household in Oregon. So that's a shortage of about 103,000 units. And we're able to look at this at the regional and county level as well to kind of get an understanding of what that deficit of units is for the lowest income households across the state.
So I have a question there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for the 133,000 people who have available to them 348,000, is that what that means?
Yes.
Units. Why would those units not decrease their price if there's such a glut of them on the market, so that the people in the red category might be able to access them?
Well, so these units are affordable. The top rent here, which is affordable at 80% of median family income, would be about $1,250.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes down to, so this is a range of about $780 to $1,250.
But you're not seeing the price for those rentals drop because there's so many more available than...
I think it's a combination, Chair. I think that folks are still competing. I mean, we have an overall shortage of housing, so mm-hmm. I think folks are just still competing, and there's a mismatch. Mm-hmm. There is certainly also a share of this stock. So this is the overall housing stock. There's a share of this that is regulated, too. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of the rents are set by external forces and our programs as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's just an overall shortage, so you just don't see that sorting out in the marketplace.
Right.
Just to comment on that, if you have, you know, if 348,000 are in a very broad category, you have that 108 in the purple on the right, mm-hmm. 108,000 that are paying a little less than the 30%. You have 112 that are paying a little more than their 30% income, mm-hmm. and some that are paying that. So mm-hmm. Those ones are going to be priced just right where you can hit both sides of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the sweet spot, this kind of thing, and everybody wants to. So moving on, what that means is that people are spending a lot of their income on housing costs and are experiencing housing cost burden. So, and this shows that that's true both among renters and owners, and it's most true, as you would expect, for the lowest income households. And so the extremely low income, and this green bar means they're severe housing cost burden, so they're spending more than 50%, more than half of their income on housing costs. And often people in this category are really spending 60, 70, or more percent of their income on housing costs, which puts them at an increased risk for homelessness. These are people who, they have very little money left over for any kind of emergency or...
Yes.
Thank you. Do you have demographics that you could share with us at some point on that 0 to 30%? What those demographics, they're just all the demographics about that group. Is it mm-hmm. kids coming out of college? Is it students? Is it seniors? Is it everybody? That sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. We have broken that down in our full assessment by race and ethnicity and by age, and a little bit on people with disabilities when we're looking at some of the populations with special needs. We have that, and we can share that.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of the needs assessment, and I just wanted to also quickly show the regions that we are using for the regional profiles. We have 8 regions here. Sort of based, and it's trying to be consistent with what other states do, but also keep community action agencies that we work with and other groups that we work with kind of in the same region. So these are the regions, and I'll just quickly go through a few kind of look at kind of what's different by region. This is one that I think really gets to the need for senior housing and kind of the needs of the senior population. It shows change in population by age, so we can see that across the board. There's a lot of growth in the 65 and over population, and in many regions we actually are seeing decreases in the younger population. So just kind of a thing to keep in mind as we're planning for the next 5 to 10 years around housing needs. This just kind of gives an indication of how poverty rates are changing and differ from region to region. They tend to be higher in more rural areas, Eastern Oregon. Go back. And in most cases, in all cases, the poverty rate has increased, with some of the biggest ones being in Central Oregon and Western Oregon, actually. And then another, what I noted earlier on the permit side is this kind of shows that the permits by region. So you can see that, as I said, it's really in Portland where we're seeing a lot of those new residential permits, whereas in a lot of other places, it's pretty stagnant. So that's still a big concern. I mean, it's still a big concern in Portland also because it's not keeping up with demand, but really a concern across the board.
Chair? Sure. Mm-hmm. Yep. Just can you tell me what MSA stands for after Portland?
Yes, that's the Metropolitan Statistical Area. So that's the Portland. That's the greater Portland. It doesn't just include Portland. It includes...
Would it perchance include Gresham?
Yes.
Okay, absolutely. So that's what I...
Yeah. And all of East County, or...?
I can actually... So it's... if you go back to the... It's Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties.
Okay, thank you.
It's what we're calling the Portland MSA.
I guess so. That's what it looks like.
And then finally, this final slide just kind of gets at renter households with severe housing burden by region. So again, just being able to look at the variation from region to region across the state. So it's just kind of a sampling of a lot of that. We have a lot more data, and we're happy to share some of that with you, but just wanted to give you kind of a sampling of what we have so far. And I'll turn it back over to Margaret.
Great. Thank you so much. Members of the committee, one of the things I wanted to do today was lead with the data so that you could understand the need that we're grappling with. And I know I was struck by the severity of the need when I saw the presentation that we just had Megan present to us. What I wanted to do is put our strategies now in context so that you understand why we're doing the work that we do to try to address some of those needs. So just a refresher, we have two main sides of our house. The first is housing stabilization, and the second one is housing finance. I want to talk briefly about housing stabilization because when we heard about that that figure, that 130,000 unit shortage of affordable housing, part of what we're trying to do with our housing stabilization strategies is to really help address the poverty of Oregonians and to help people be able to maintain the housing that they have so that we can shore up folks' living situations so that we don't have an even greater need or a greater housing instability of folks searching for housing. So I want to make sure folks understand that. And then certainly our housing finance strategies really aim to make strategic investments to provide more rental housing and homeownership opportunities for Oregonians that need those housing opportunities. So when I came before the committee last week, I spoke about two of our key stabilization programs, homelessness prevention and individual development accounts. So I'm going to finish rounding out that presentation by talking about our energy and weatherization programs, and then I'll switch to talk about our housing finance strategies. So for our energy assistance work, we help to mitigate high energy costs for low-income Oregonians through bill payment assistance, energy crisis assistance, case management, energy education, and heating system repair and replacement. The majority of our funds for this program come from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Portland General Electric, and Pacific Power. And again, we work through our statewide network of community action agencies. We are working to make these programs more user-friendly, streamlining our application processes, and refining our program performance measures. And a little bit about our accomplishments last year through energy assistance. In federal fiscal year 2016, we assisted more than 81,000 families across the state. We prevented disconnection of energy services for more than 44,000 households. An average annual household benefit of over $350, which can be a real lifeline for low-income Oregonians. And we had more than 9,000 first-time program users. So again, really helping people to be able to alleviate their housing cost burden with that energy assistance. And related to that work, our weatherization program provides energy conservation services at no cost to Oregon low-income families. Our services include home health and safety improvements, heating system repair and replacement, window and door repair and replacement, energy education, and energy baseload reduction measures. Here again, our largest funders are federal funders, U.S. Department of Energy and the Department of Health and Human Services. We also receive funds through Bonneville Power through the federal government, as well as Portland General Electric and Pacific Power, and we work with our community action agencies here as well. Really tremendous impact of this program. Calendar year 2016, we served more than 1,300 households, total estimated energy savings of over $773,000, and an average annual household savings of more than $500. But in order to really explain the impact of this program, we wanted to provide you with a real-life example of weatherization to really bring home the point that it's not just the energy savings, it's really that work to help people be able to maintain their homeownership or their rental tenancy to be able to stay in their home. So here's one example from the community action team in St. Helens. This participant was referred to the community action team healthy home specialist, visited his older manufactured home in St. Helens. There's pride of ownership, but this resident has suffered multiple falls. And as you can see, there were unsafe living conditions, a need for repair of basic needs in the home, stairs and other features. And so just to give you an example of some of the work that was done through the program, they made improvements, including new stairs, handrails, grab bars, a new storm door, and really helped that individual be able to maintain this home and to be able to stay in that home and be safe, as well as all the weatherization benefits as well. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk about our housing finance section. So again, this section of our agency really does the investment in building and preserving rental housing, as well as homeownership opportunities for low-income Oregonians. So our multifamily housing programs administer low-interest loan and grant programs, the Federal Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, and other funding sources for affordable multifamily housing, rental housing development, and preservation. We are working to target target underserved populations, so certainly some of the special populations that Megan spoke about in her presentation. We're working to improve our application processes. We have a number of new programs that we're implementing this year. I'll be speaking in detail about the new LIFT program, which we're very excited about, as well as a new mental health housing program and the new National Housing Trust Fund program as well. We're also partnering with our friends at the Oregon Health Authority and DHS to try to produce new supportive housing models and integrate resident services into our housing as well. So a snapshot and a summary of our work in the multifamily housing arena. Last year, we had several awards we made through notices of funding availability. We made more than $56 million available through key funding sources. So the HOME program and the 9% low-income housing tax credit program are both federal funds, federal sources of funding. The mental health housing program is a new state program we're very excited about. We made an initial $3.7 million of awards. We're going back out with another NOFA here in the next few weeks to make an additional more than $16 million available for mental health. And then the Local Innovation Fast Track LIFT program, of course, made nearly $40 million available just last month. So all in all, those investments are creating or preserving more than 1,600 units of rental housing. In addition, we also administer the non-competitive federal program, which is the 4% low-income housing tax credit program, which we pair with conduit bonds. And we have a number of other funding sources that come from the state, including the document recording fee funds, the housing development grant program, other gap funds, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, the Oregon Agricultural Worker Tax Credit Program, and the lottery-backed bonds for preservation. So through those sources, as well as the sources I just mentioned, we were able to preserve or develop more than 2,400 affordable rental homes just last year, which we're very excited about. And now, certainly want to highlight the exciting successes of the new LIFT program. So LIFT is the Local Innovation and Fast-Tracked Housing Program. It was approved in 2015. It's a new use of Article 11Q bonds to fund the LIFT program. To be eligible, projects must serve rural communities of 25,000 population or less, or serve historically underserved populations by partnering with culturally specific organizations. Our NOFA funding process gave primary funding consideration to projects that were requesting $38,000 per unit or less in this LIFT subsidy source. Projects that were requesting more than $38,000 per unit received secondary consideration. And we gave a strong preference to projects that included innovation resulting in lower development costs and increased replicability, and projects that incorporated new partnerships with DHS offices on the ground, including work to serve child welfare or family self-sufficiency program participants. So last month, we were very excited to make the first set of LIFT awards to 12 projects to provide housing to more than 960 Oregon families and communities in need. And without further ado, here's the list of awardees for the LIFT program. Again, 12 projects all across the state and a really wide diversity of housing types, of sponsors, and types of programs. So as you can see, we're funding all over the state, everywhere from Tigard to Sisters, Woodburn to Lapine. So we're excited about that. We certainly are reaching parts of the state that we do not typically reach with our competitive process. So, for example, on the coast and other places that really haven't seen any of those building permits pulled recently. And we're excited that we're doing both small projects and large projects. I think we have a lot to learn from this first cadre of LIFT awards. And as I'm sure you're aware, the governor in her recommended budget is proposing $60 million in additional investment for the LIFT program. So we look forward to talking more about that as well.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a quick question on the funding, the $38,000 mark, benchmark. How many of those projects that were awarded were over the $38,000? Do you have any statistics?
Certainly. Thank you so much for the question. The We had, I think, two of the 12 projects were above the 38,000 mark. One of the interesting things that we saw was we saw an array of approaches to funding. So we saw some projects come in and they were below the 38,000 lift threshold, but that's because they paired a number of other funding sources. So it's not to say that the overall development cost was below that mark. And then we saw some projects that came in with fewer funding sources because there was less availability in their region, for example. So they were above that lift threshold, but the overall development cost was still below what we would typically see.
So, great. That's a great problem.
Thank you. Love it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I wanted to round out by talking about homeownership. Certainly, we saw the data about the declining homeownership rates. We do have a very active program in our single-family section, which is dedicated to assisting low- and moderate-income families through homeownership centers across the state. We're working to expand our single-family bond program to better serve target populations. We are very excited. We're off to a very, very bold start with our single-family program this year. In fact, we've doubled our activity from this time last year. So that is wonderful news. And we're working again here to streamline our grants administration work. And finally, we're working to prevent and address the impact of foreclosures through our Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative. This is a federal program through the U.S. Treasury. It's part of the hardest hit funds, which is from the Troubled Asset Relief Program. We've assisted more than 11,000 struggling homeowners through this program over the past few years, and we've allocated more than $204 million through the OHSI program. So it's a significant investment. We received an additional grant award of $94.5 million last year. So we had wrapped up the initial phase of OHSI, and we're feeling great about that. And then we were lucky enough to receive another federal grant. So we're ramping back up the activity. And what we do here is to try to address homeowners that may be behind on their mortgage payments, maybe behind on their back taxes for their real estate, to be able to stay in their homes by either restructuring their loans or helping them to catch up with those mortgage payments. So that's a brief summary of our programs and our strategies, and I would be pleased to take any questions. Thank you.
Well, we have a very full agenda after this, but that was a fantastic presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Chair.
A lot to go back to.
Great.
We'll
Thank
be
you.
Referring back to it often, I'm sure. Okay, next we have Mark McMullen, state economist, with more data.
Yeah.
More data.
Thank you. Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Mark McMullen, the Oregon State Economist, and I'm here today to give some high-level comments on housing supply. What my office can really offer is a very 30,000-foot view, but even from that distance, it's pretty clear that there's something broken with our supply channels in terms of not creating enough housing for the growth in the population, the underlying growth in the population that we're seeing. So the first chart I wanted to show has to do with housing affordability across the state, because while housing affordability is, the problems with housing affordability are very pronounced in Portland and Central Oregon and some of our major metropolitan areas, that's not the only place where we're having trouble. In fact, it's really widespread across the state. Just one quick aside, when economists typically talk about housing affordability, we're talking about a little different than what we heard earlier, which was affordable housing. Affordable housing, which is addressing the needs of our low-income residents, is a little different than what economists look at and what we're looking at here, which in housing affordability, we're just comparing a typical or median household, what their income is versus what the housing costs are. Mm-hmm. And so to what extent are housing costs eating up their available resources? And so here we're looking at all non-metropolitan counties. So we're talking, that's how we're defining rural here across the U.S. And those bright red ones are where the affordability issues are really stark. So those would be akin to a hot metropolitan area where the housing is in short supply. And as you said, across Oregon, much of the broader Mountain West, affordability is an issue. Now, some of these, just in some of this, is a function of the way we define this affordability, comparing the house prices to the local incomes. In particular, what we see here are resort and vacation areas across the country stand out because they get a lot of housing demand from outside of the area. It might not really tie in with local incomes, but incomes from elsewhere, like in our coastal areas here. But you see it across the country with the ski resorts and the Poconos in Florida and the Boundary Waters up in the upper Midwest, where there are a lot of vacation homes and a lot of external demand. These things tend to be expensive relative to what local folks earn. But nevertheless, we know that a lot of our counties, in particular way out east, aren't necessarily vacation hubs. And so there's clearly an issue here. And for us, the reason most of Oregon's rural counties are red isn't because we have low incomes. The incomes in rural Oregon are roughly the same as they are in the rest of the U.S., rural U.S., but rather that we have high prices, that in most of our rural counties they're about, in the 95th percentile or something along those lines. So it's clearly an issue across the state and not getting any better because we're really not seeing a lot of supply come in. There's really something that's broken in terms of this supply reaction in the economy. There are high prices a lot of places, but we're waiting for developers and entrepreneurs to come in and build in response to those. Here we're looking at numbers for across the state, where we're comparing permitting in 2015 relative to the 2000 to 2004 average. We just picked that period as what would be a typical period. It's pretty arbitrary, but it was before we got into the real building boom. So what in a normal period, a recent normal period for Oregon, what was permitting like? And you see across the state down anywhere from a third to a half the size of what it would be in a normal period. And this isn't just across Oregon, it's really across the U.S. as well. This is a phenomenon that we're seeing everywhere, and that's something that you need to highlight, is that it's really not everywhere in the U.S., because places that aren't seeing population growth obviously don't have the problem, but in any hot or magnet type of state or metropolitan areas, it's been very difficult for builders to keep up. Looking at the adding it all together at the broad statewide level, permits do seem to have been really low in terms of, this is a rough measure of underbuilding, but here for almost a decade now, we're having trouble keeping up in terms of building enough to keep up with the population that's coming in. So the black line are actual permits, and the red line again is just a benchmark for what normally would happen. So this is a historical average from 1980 to 2004. If you were to really do it right, the amount we need to keep up with population would depend on changing home ownership rates, how at what pace the existing stock is getting retired or becoming obsolete, and you could do a dissertation on it. But just here to get an idea and a benchmark of if we're building enough, we're just looking at the historical average, which was one permit for a little over every two new people that came into Oregon. So that's historically what we've seen over the past, and we really haven't been able to keep up with that since 2005 or the like. And it's,
may I ask a question?
Yes.
So can you tell from this how many units we've underbuilt over the past decade?
Yes, you could. You could put some up from this last decade. Of course, there was a little bit of overbuilding before that, and to average those periods, it's a little. Starting point is important, but roughly we're looking at a year and a half or so being behind in terms of building, which is some roughly 30,000, a little bit more, 35,000 units, something like that across the state. But it's also important to say, of course, that housing markets are very local, and it depends on the kind of housing and this is quite an abstraction when we stand up and say, oh, we need this many units across the state. We obviously don't need a high-rise luxury apartment building in Burns right now, and maybe not even in downtown Portland. That's the one thing we do have a lot of building in, is, in this upper end. But nevertheless, just looking at the again, the total numbers, we're just not keeping up. And it's and so this is the concern for economists, because the prices have been so strong. And builders and developers are making a lot of money on the units that they do get out there. So it appears that something's broken, that this profit motive that we rely on, you know, isn't working. So there's a potential really role for public policy here, but we have to figure out what's gone wrong. So when we talk to folks around the state, we get a few answers to that. One of the most popular ones, of course, is that it's the government's fault. That, you know, in Oregon we have a strong history of zoning laws and anti-sprawl legislation and the like, and since right now it's clear that builders are having a hard time getting buildable lots, maybe it's our fault because of our regional planning. But and that certainly probably has something to do with it. That's obviously the point of regional planning. You're going to restrict supply to a certain extent. But the fact that we're seeing this across the country, and we're still seeing supply shortages in some of the places that love to build, the rapidly growing places are comparison metropolitan areas like Boise and Austin that are growing fast, bringing in households sort of like our Portland metropolitan area are. But these places are in the top 5% or so of building across the country, and even they can't keep up. And they're seeing really low vacancy rates too, just like us. So it's not just our public policy. Another place...
Should keep moving through.
Yes.
I know you have other slides to get to, and I will.
Absolutely. I'm not going to go through the income ones at the end. I'm going to stop after the supply. So I've got three more minutes to go.
Okay.
So some folks are worried about construction workers, the lack of construction workers. Not a ton of evidence in the top line data for that, but that's another one that people bring up. And perhaps developers are a little bit cautious and scared because of what happened to them, in the downturn, maybe they're worried about changing preferences of millennials and the like. But that one's hard to swallow as well, because developers, by their nature, are very confident, very optimistic. You have to be a successful developer. You have to stick your neck out and be willing to do so. But other folks in the process, in particular in the funding process, are not necessarily as optimistic and maybe be a little bit more risk averse, in particular bankers and the bank regulators. And this is one place where we may be on to something. As you see here, in the last year or so, we've seen lending standards tighten, particularly for construction and land development loans. Like I say, we're missing this supply of buildable lots, yet lenders are making it tougher and tougher to borrow money. And so the bankers say, well, it's not just us being scared, it's the regulators. They're asking now for larger capital requirements for our land development loans, and they're looking less favorably on our portfolio if we have a lot of real estate in it after the crash. And so this really probably could be probably the most reasonable suspect in terms of what's going on, but nevertheless, we're not keeping up in terms of supply. This is very much different in terms of why we're seeing the price increases we are now versus in the past. It's largely a supply phenomenon, and that really works across regions of the state, across the country, and across income tiers and price tiers in the market. So that's all the time I had. I was going to talk a little bit more about income side, but any follow-ups you have, please feel free to reach out. Our contact is there, and we'd be happy to try to dig into the data further for any of you.
Great. And we have a question from Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming today. It's very informative. going back to the comment about the profits for the developers and whatnot, that you alleged that they were making plenty of profit. Do we have any data to show those numbers actually in some way to actually show that, yes, there is tons of profit, so maybe there's something else that's keeping people from just jumping on developing more?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hurd, that's a good question. You know, I'm taking it from anecdotes. Anecdotally from our developers that they're doing pretty well. Now, that's starting to get very tight in Portland and the multifamily stuff. That's now we're starting to see where some of this stuff isn't penciling out.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, developers are not building, not because they don't see a fat profit on their paper, but because they can't get the lots. But yeah, I will dig in and see if there is any top line data on that. I suspect not, because it's very forward looking, you know, what the expectations of prices are.
Follow up, please.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Also, I would be interested in trying to see if we can figure out if there's a disconnect, maybe there isn't, but if there is a disconnect between rural development versus developers in the more metropolitan areas. And then my final thought is also, what role is what I would label as extreme levels of regulation, whether it's federal, state, what have you, county and city for that matter, that's playing a role in discouraging folks from putting their, because I mean, for myself as a small contractor, it's not always about profit. When I size up a customer, a lot of times I'm like, this person's putting off the vibe, or this community's putting off the vibe that I could make $1 million. I could also lose $1 million if things go wrong because of the dynamics of who I'm going into business with, so to speak. So as far as that goes, I'd like to see if we can dig a little deeper on maybe what regulations are doing as far as discouraging people from jumping in on what perceivably is a high profit investment, but yet they're not jumping on it. So
absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative Hurd. Yeah, just it's obvious that regulations hurt insofar as just talk to anyone who's in the industry, right? And this is one of the first things that comes up. But again, the issue today, when we stand back, is so broad. It gets around so many different places in the country and so many different types of places, rural and urban in Oregon, that it some places that are heavily regulated and other places that are much less so. Mm-hmm. And so while regulation is, I wouldn't argue that it doesn't matter, because everyone you talk to in the industry tells you it's a big deal. But right now there's something else going on, because it's so broad, because we're seeing the problems in so many places and not just the heavily regulated ones.
So one more question from
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I know we're getting time crunch here, but there is a lot of validity to the attitudes and concerns with builders, developers. I'm working with them, and a lot of them are looking at land now that they're trying to purchase that's going to take 2 years to get on board through the development process. And, you know, one of my questions is, and a lot of them are very worried about, if they're going to be buying land next year that's 2 years out, what's the market going to be like? Are they making a risk to bring on lots and land and developments that won't potentially sell for what they're trying to pencil out now? So I think, you know, maybe some ideas on policy changes that we can do to get these folks streamlined through and get the housing on market quicker. Get their attitude. They're making money now, but they're concerned about their investment now to see if it will pay off 2 years from now. So those are some issues that they're dealing with.
Thank you. And I do want, if you can just go back just to point out, because you skipped it really quickly, the rental income, the increasing share.
Oh, yes.
Of the increasing price of rents and the increasing share of income going to those rents. I think that's a very significant slide. So I just want to point that out. Thank you so much for coming and giving us in it. These are points for us to go back to and dig into deeper. It's, I know, really a lot of data, big picture right now.
Yes.
And so next we have Doug Stamm, the CEO and president of Meyer Oil Trust. You've got your
Morning.
Team with you, if you'd like to bring them up.
Teresa, Michael, there's two seats here. Yeah, Teresa Diebel, who heads up the Meyer Trust Affordable Housing Group, and Michael Parkhurst, who is a big brain on the subject and has been working on it for a lot of years with a number of municipalities around the state. So, and Jody Marshall is here as one of our program associates. So thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and the committee, for giving me an opportunity. I think I actually will come in under time here. So you
catch us back up.
What's that?
You'll catch
us back. I'll try to help you catch up a little bit. But I was just struck by the uniqueness.
Oh, yes, if you could start with your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Doug Stamm. I'm the CEO of the Meyer Memorial Trust and have been in that position for 15 years after following on a career in the private sector. So I was struck by the fact that I think we're in a bit of a unique position here compared to the other folks that you're hearing from today, both at the state level and a number of the nonprofit folks that you'll be hearing from that are in this sector are people that we work with directly. And so they're very familiar to us, but as a private foundation, we have a very different role in this whole milieu of affordable housing. So I appreciate the opportunity to have a chance to talk to you a little bit about our approach to affordable housing and how that may help inform some of your thoughts as you're approaching some of the legislation that will be in front of you in this very challenging session. Let me just give you a very quick snapshot of the Meyer Memorial Trust. It's the personal legacy of Fred G. Meyer. It was established 33 years ago after his death. At the time, it was the largest private foundation in the Pacific Northwest, and today, our corpus is at about $750 million. We distribute somewhere between $35 to $40 million a year across the state in each one of your districts and in every corner of the state. And we share a lot of the same concerns that you do. What we're trying to do is positively impact and improve the lives of Oregonians. In 2017, we anticipate awarding an additional $36 million, and I'll talk in a moment about how some of that will be allocated in the affordable housing sector. The unique aspect of the way a private foundation can work alongside and partner with both the state and a number of the providers you'll hear from today is that we have very flexible dollars. We don't face some of the constraints that both the state and the nonprofit providers do, but our goal is the same, and that is to make a difference in this state and to move towards our vision of what we consider to be a flourishing and equitable Oregon. Housing has, in the 33 years, and like I said, I've been there 15, so I have a good sense of the history of the trust as well. Housing has been one of our top priorities since inception. And we believe and assert that to reach full potential, people need a home that's stable, safe, and reasonably affordable. And as you already heard some of the testimony this morning, some of the cost burdens that are presented are making that very difficult. And when these housing costs rise too high, households and families have to make those brutally difficult decisions about paying rent or buying food, buying medicine, utilities, their transportation, etc. More specifically, research, and I did not bring data with me, but we're happy to provide this afterwards. Research continues to show that housing instability contributes directly to poor performance in school. We see that across the state, difficulties in getting and keeping a good job, and even leads to poor health outcomes. We're working hard, Oregon's working hard, to help our citizens succeed. But every other investment we make is jeopardized when people cannot find affordable and stable housing. And unfortunately, the federal government, as noted recently in some testimony provided by Multnomah County Commission Chair Deborah Cafori, has really taken a diminished role in this field. And in the past 30 years, through the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has declined funding, and which has had deep ramifications for this state and states across the country. And we don't expect that that will improve over the next 4 years with the current administration. So the responsibility falls in great part to state and local governments to fill this gap. In our role, in the last about 8 years, we've distributed $25 million specifically targeted to affordable housing. And in a number of the areas that will be in front of you in legislation, and we've particularly focused on the preservation of existing affordable housing. We do support some new housing units, but we believe in preservation. I'll talk more about that in a minute. We have a robust rural housing project and particularly focus on manufactured homes and manufactured home parks. And we also work closely with the nonprofit providers to strengthen those organizations, to advocate with those organizations. We've had groups of private and public developers and folks from the state involved in cost efficiency groups and have published reports on that. And we're very interested in working hard to better align social services with housing, as you've heard today from the folks from the state housing group. So I'm not here today to advocate for any specific policy change. I wish I could, but as a private foundation, we are prohibited by law from advocating, but I have the opportunity to educate is what the law says. But so I want to just briefly share what we've learned and ask you to consider how you might apply this when the different legislation comes before you to make a difference in the area of affordable housing. First and foremost, we're absolutely convinced that the state is the most capable force to make a difference here. If we can't, as a public sector, make a statement towards sustained, significant commitment to helping the neediest of all Oregonians with their urgent housing needs, we can expect to see a sharp increase in the thousands of people that we're already seeing sleeping in doorways, sleeping under bridges, in tent cities, under overpasses, and in substandard manufactured housing, particularly across rural Oregon. The second thing I'd urge you to think about is viewing housing as basic infrastructure, as you view sewers, parks, community centers, schools. And unless we actively plan to expand affordable housing and invest in affordable housing, we know that need will continue to grow, just as some of the needs that we see now with basic infrastructure, transportation. I know you're going to be facing some difficult decisions there, and we cannot afford to continue to neglect affordable housing. Third, through funding sources like federal and state tax credits, we've evolved into a system of primarily nonprofit-driven development that creates high-quality, permanently affordable housing, and I know you're going to hear from a number of those representatives today. That system carries out a public function, and therefore we believe that it needs and deserves public support. Fourth, as I mentioned earlier, preservation. We think it's important to preserve what we have and not neglect or squander the investments that we've already made. And last, and it's been mentioned earlier, that the alignment of resources between the social sector and housing, healthcare, mental health, and supportive services made great progress in the last few years. Still a lot to be done there. So you have a lot of challenges in front of you in the next few months, and we urge you to continue to find ways to meaningfully support affordable housing through not only investments, but also through your public policy. And you heard the state economist just talk a little bit about some policy changes and regulations that can improve not only home building, but affordable home building. And we would urge you to pay close attention to the Housing Alliance agenda that will be presented to you. I know it's not a small problem, but it's one of the most critical facing this state, and one that we can make measurable progress against. So thank you for hearing us out today, and we'll take any questions you may have. And as Chair Kenny Geyer knows, we're available to work with the legislature or work with other groups to provide the research and background that some of the technical assistance that we've been involved with in around affordable housing for the past 10 years.
Thank you so much for that high-level view and for your commitment to housing is foundational to all the other areas that you invest in. And Michael, I know that I believe it was you that authored the report on the cost drivers for new supply.
That's true.
Please introduce yourself.
Michael Parkhurst. I'm a program officer at the Trust.
So if you would send that to our committee administrator, I think it would be great to have that report online so people can refer back to it, because this is the day you're probably going to remember for a lot of these pieces of information. That was really excellent work. So thank you so much for your bringing your team and having a commitment to this area.
Thanks for
and supporting a lot of the nonprofits that are doing the problem solving out there.
Yeah. We are in all of your districts.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your dedicated work.
Thank you. Okay, great. And next we have Dan Herman, CEO of 211. And I know this is a very short presentation. So Dan, I know we squeezed you in at the last minute, and I know it's a short presentation mostly, so you can draw attention to the very important material that you've submitted onto OLIS.
I'll be Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, mm-hmm. Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. Thank you for having me in as part of this discussion, very important discussion. What I wanted to do, I'm Dan Herman, the CEO of 211 Info. What I wanted to do was give an overview, some of the top headlines of some of the data we're going to look at in a moment here. Probably firstly, a quick refresher, and I'll be brief on all our points this morning. 211 Info, as a refresh, is a 501c operating statewide. And our primary capabilities are to be an information and referral provider, and we do that across multiple platforms, telephone, web, email, mobile apps, texting. And then we house a database and maintain a database of 42,000 programs and services for the people that contact us. As a result, we get some pretty robust data, and we're looking to improve upon those data capabilities and the analytics and reporting. And then also we're able to dispense public information through our social media platforms, our following, our newsletter.
You can stand back a little bit from the...
Our social media platform and newsletter and marketing capabilities, both social and outreach. So with that in mind, I'm going to draw your attention to the data that we put together for this discussion. And know that this is primary data and that these are folks that are self-reporting this information to us. So I think one of the first headlines as we get started here is if you look at these buckets, if you will, from housing down to other governmental and economic services, you can see the pervasiveness of the problem. It's nearly 35% of contacts that we had January 1 through December 31, 2016, had to do with housing. So it's a far spread, far-reaching problem for our contacts, our consumers. If you go through that filter down below in the next section, you'll see if you look at the filter, you look at the bucket that is housing, you'll see far and away that rent payment assistance at 26% is the greatest request or the greatest need. And then continuing on down, shelters too, right on down through the list there. Moving forward, if you simply look at the housing service requests by metropolitan area across the state, Portland's high at 51%, but then you see the other cities across the state. Taking that absolute data and putting it into a visual form, you'll see the county-by-county reporting in terms of housing and how that county, the percentage of the calls, contacts from that county represented housing needs.
And you flip it down so we catch up with your...
Sure. There's contacts by city. Represented graphically. And now you'll see the number of housing requests within each county is the numerator. The denominator is total contacts from that county. So you can see Multnomah at 42%, Deschutes County at 63%, right on across the board in the various counties. Turning to demographic data, about 75% of the contacts related to housing are female, which is pretty much on par with our overall base, if you will. You'll see that it affects really the prime working years. Some comments were made earlier about the ability to get employment, the importance of housing as it relates to employment and overall social determinants of health. So when you look at the demographic breakdown, you'll see the age spectrum. Moving down below, about 75% of our contacts are at no income to poverty level. In the case of housing, it's about 88% are at no income up to poverty level. So you see that graphically represented in the bar chart. And then down below, in terms of race and ethnicity, The piece that really sticks out here is African American at 21%, which is nearly 10 times the index that is African American population of Oregon. Moving down a few more points. If you look at health insurance status, you'll see that some 63% of the contacts made to 211 around housing have Medicaid. Years ago, before the ACA, just a side point here, a prevalence of our calls were around health insurance. As we shored that up and gave vulnerable populations the protection, the insurance, the coverage that they need, that piece has really been minimized outside of dental need, with the aside of dental need. Should we not be able to maintain some kind of protection for vulnerable populations, we suspect that there'll be a cascading effect that is housing and health insurance that will simply probably assist the magnitude of the problem. I think that's an important point on the side. A couple more points. Are you currently homeless? You see the information there. And then coming down below the last set of points, this does affect children. 66% of the contacts to 211 around housing have children in the household. And then lastly, you'll see that the frequency, the fact of people calling us repeatedly around housing need, repeat caller or contact 57%, first time 43%. That 57% is higher than our baseline, which is typically 50% new, 50% returning. So with that, I give you a little bit of primary data, hopefully add some insight and some texture to what you all have to grapple with. I'll gladly take questions.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I appreciated the ability to tour your facility up by the airport and really am thankful for all the work that you do. Coming from a local agency used to refer people to 211.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. We enjoy the work, and we were glad to have you in. Representative Noble, thank you.
I would encourage anyone to go on a tour with 211. It's now statewide as well.
Yes.
And I remember a conversation we had maybe a year and a half ago where I was asking about what are the kind of calls that you get, and you have really shored up your ability to collect that data and then to present it back in a really usable way. So thank you for all your work.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, great.
And
thank you.
That's a good segue to a plug that this Friday at the Capitol in room 350, it will be 211 day, although it's February 10th, and we encourage you to come by. You'll actually see our
And we're not going to be here Saturday, you mean.
They're on Saturday, but you'll see our operation. We'll take calls from there. We'll have data reporting available there, so please join us if you get an opportunity.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Great. Well, now we've had some kind of big statewide looks, and now we're going to have some regional looks. So we're starting with Bill Hall, Lincoln County Commissioner.
I've got a PowerPoint. Well, good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez and Stark, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hall. I am now in my fourth term as a Lincoln County Commissioner. Time does fly when you're having fun. And I'm also serving this year as Chair President of the Association of Oregon Counties. And I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about how the housing crisis has impacted Lincoln County. Let's see. Go forward.
Next.
How do we
see?
Do that. Okay. I see housing availability in Lincoln County as having multiple impacts: economic, public safety, educational, community health, and community diversity. And I'm just going to try and move through those very quickly here. I hear again and again from both public and private employers that the lack of affordable, decent rental opportunities and home ownership opportunities is absolutely their number one barrier to employee recruitment and retention. It's affected our County Health and Human Services Department, our school district, private businesses of all kinds. Let me talk about our County Health and Human Services Department. It is the largest single department in Lincoln County. In addition to operating traditional public health services and behavioral health services, we operate a network of federally qualified health centers, four school-based health centers, and two adult clinics. We have had major difficulty in filling positions for psychiatric nurse practitioners, dietitians. One of our behavioral health managers left county employment after 9 months because he never found suitable housing. He was living in a campground his entire time on the coast. Going to cheat just a little bit, this example of private business impact is actually from the south end of Tillamook County, but it was the subject of an interesting newspaper write-up. That is a sign that was posted in the window of Marizano's, a popular restaurant in Manzanita, last summer. They said that they were unable to open their dining room for the first time in 15 years. And why? They couldn't recruit enough staff. The reason? Housing availability. They stayed open for takeout, but they could not staff a dining room. And of course, it's not just tourism-related businesses who suffer. During last year's session, when I testified on another housing-related bill, the pilot program to make it easier to expand urban growth boundaries, Representative Bueller thanked me after the hearing. He said that he and some friends are partners in a small high-tech business in Newport. Their number one recruiting issue, well, I'm starting to sound like a broken record, housing. This is something that I don't hear come up as much in the housing discussion, but really concerns me is we talk a lot about disaster resiliency, and we're working on it, and we should be. But what happens when a lot of vital folks to the community, first responders, doctors, nurses, police, firefighters, can't afford to live in the communities they serve? I don't have a lot of hard data on this, but I can tell you Lincoln City's now retired city manager, during the dozen years he was on the job, was tracking the number of city employees who lived within the Lincoln City zip code. At the start of his tenure, it was two-thirds of the city's workforce. By the time he left, it was one-third of the workforce. So that's all city employees. But think about public works, police, you know, the other vital folks. If they can't live in the community that they're serving in the time of crisis, I think we're going to have a response problem. This is something that has attracted a lot of attention. Lincoln County is one of the few statewide or countywide school districts in the state. When I started working this issue a dozen years ago, we had 400 students who met the definition of homelessness under the McKinney-Vento Act. Last year, we almost hit 1,970. That's 14.5% of the district enrollment versus, you know, about 4% statewide. And there is all kinds of data, which I hope you're aware of or would be easy to track down, tying homelessness to poor academic performance, poor physical and mental health outcomes for students. You know, right now it's over 400 homeless in Lincoln City alone, which, as I said a dozen years ago, was the district-wide total. Community diversity suffers. You know, one thing that I hear again and again is that people believe that hardworking families ought to be able to afford to live in the communities where they work. And I think most people would agree that our strength is our diversity. But again, what happens if people of lower income levels can't afford to live in the city that they work in? So, what's driving this? A lot of the statewide issues that you've already heard about. I think there's some unique factors along the coast as well. You know, certainly geographic issues. Any frontage or view land is not going to be suitable for affordable housing for ownership or rental. Other geographic constraints. If you go east, you're going to run into forests or farms. If you go west, you're going to get wet. So basically, you've got to build north and south. Another big driver is, and I know this also is something folks in the Gorge are dealing with, Central Oregon, but the growing number of vacation rentals and part-time residences. I heard the city manager of Manzanita say 75% of their homes are not full-time owner-occupied. It's not quite as bad in Lincoln County, but Lincoln City, say, 40% owner-occupied. A lot of people talk about the vacation rentals, which makes up another 30% of Lincoln City's housing stock. But what doesn't get talked about as much is that other 30% that it's not in the rental pool, but it's not full-time owner-occupied either. It's a weekend retreat or maybe a snowbird's summer home. And I am glad that Mr. Stamm mentioned the Housing Alliance. I have been participating in the work of the Housing Alliance for several sessions now. You know, the problem may seem big, almost overwhelming, especially given the depth of the budget challenges I know you're facing this session. But there are lots of things on the Housing Alliance agenda that I would encourage you to take a look at. The governor's proposal for $60 million more in bonding for Lyft certainly would be one avenue, and I happened to be in a meeting with the governor yesterday along with representatives of the League of Cities, and she happened to mention that very proposal and said if the legislature saw fit to increase that $60 million figure, she would have no objections to that. So I thank you for the opportunity. Would be glad to answer questions if there are any.
Any questions? Thank you for coming all over the coastal range to join us today.
Yeah.
Really appreciate that. Thank you for all your work. Bill was very modest in his introduction, but he has served on national homeless committees and a whole variety of things over many, many years, so very long-term commitment to this issue. Thank you. So next we have Michael Bonacore, Executive Director of Home Forward.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Michael Bonacore. I'm the executive director of Home Forward. We're the housing authority for Multnomah County. Chair Kenny Geyer, Chairs Stark and Sanchez, and committee members, thank you for having me today. I'm going to offer a couple of data points, but I thought I'd give you maybe a little respite from data and share a story with you that I hope kind of helps to round out some of what you've heard this morning. So about a year and a half ago, I found myself in a conversation with a woman who I'll call Alice, and she is a senior citizen living on a fixed income. She had recently gotten notice at her apartment complex informally from the property management company that in about 4 months there was going to be a significant rent increase, and that was going to price Alice and many of her neighbors out. And that's the kind of story that I know all of you have heard probably a lot over the last several months. Probably less commonly, you have heard that from people who have housing choice vouchers, but Alice was a Home Forward housing choice voucher holder. So the amount of subsidy that we were able to provide based on Alice's bedroom size, there's a limit to how much that is, and the rent increase was going to be above that amount. So if Alice wanted to stay, she was going to have to make up the difference. And again, on a fixed income, that gap was too big for her to cover. There's a lot about this crisis that we're in that we shouldn't find ourselves facing, and we shouldn't be talking about folks who already have what should be the security of a deep rental subsidy faced with the prospect of homelessness. Because if Alice had to leave her apartment and wasn't able to find another place to live with her voucher, it would have been useful to her. She was at risk of homelessness. Now, Alice was in reasonably good health. She was self-possessed and civic-minded. She was interested in grappling with this issue to solve her own situation, but to help others as well. And there are many in our community with housing subsidies and not, who are essentially invisible to us and who don't have a sense of their voice, their ability to advocate for themselves. And I think this really lends a sense of the depth of need and how much of it may be even yet invisible to us today. And again, if we are, if we're looking at a community of folks who are housed now but precariously, when we already know how many folks are on our streets, it really speaks to, again, to the depth of this issue. Last year, our staff processed over 3,200 rent increase requests from landlords. In 2012, the average increase was just over 5%. Last year, it was just over 10%. And so that's a reflection of what's happening for folks who are already on the program, for folks who are pulled from our waiting list. In 2010, about 80% of those folks who got pulled from the waiting list and were issued a voucher were able to find a place to live with them. We're now hovering around 70%, and in many communities across the state, that number is actually dramatically lower. So I'm sure that as you're thinking about housing and homelessness needs, you'd like to at least take comfort in the thought that the folks that are helped by your local housing authority are relatively stable, and in many cases they are, but in some cases they're not. And so I don't think you'll find it surprising that what I would submit to you is that we do need additional resources to increase the supply of affordable housing. I could, but won't, go on at great length about the critical importance of preserving the existing housing stock that we have, that exists in communities and in neighborhoods where it couldn't be rebuilt at the scale that it is. And critically, Alice is a reflection of the fact that we need the ability at the local level to have policy tools that allow us to provide protections for renters who find themselves in these precarious situations. So again, thank you so much for the time this morning. I appreciate being here.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming down. Next, we have Peggy McGuire, Director of Housing and Energy Services, Linn County Community Action Agency.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Sparks and Stark, good members of the committee. Thanks for inviting me. I am Peggy McGuire. I'm the Housing and Energy Services Director for Community Services Consortium. We're the community action agency that serves Linn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. Commissioner Hall, whom you just heard from not too long ago, is one of our governing board members. So he gave you a lot of information about Lincoln County. I'm going to try to globally give you some information across our service area. You know, as I was growing up, my grandfather used to always tell me stories about when he was growing up, and that oftentimes they had chicken shadow soup, and that was that you waved the chicken over the boiling water, and the only nutrients and flavorings that you got from your chicken was where the shadow crossed the boiling water in the soup. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of our families in our service delivery area are seeing right now. They're just struggling. You heard a lot of poverty data from the folks at OHCS, and you may probably know that United Way also has done some studies about housing stability for families. They call their report ALICE, Assets Limited, Income Constrained, but they're employed. And that's where the vast majority of our clients fall, the category they fall into. 40% of the clients across our service delivery area are really struggling. They're paying more than 50% of their income for rent. They're paying more than 35% of their income for their utilities. And they're unable to find affordable housing in the areas that are closest to the city centers, and having to move further and further out in rural areas, which adds to their transportation transportation burden. So you saw in the 211 numbers, the list of all the things that people call for, transportation was very high on the list. Oftentimes, people don't have very economical methods of transportation, and there may not be a good bus service. Our Lincoln County clients, if they have to go home because they forgot a piece of paperwork that's important to proving their income eligibility, might spend the entire day traveling back home. And that's very difficult when you have some small children along with you and trying to deal with the things that you're dealing with. You can't just pop in at McDonald's and feed the kids because you can't afford to. So we see that, we see those issues over and over. We have had about 3,000 energy assistance clients come into our agency since the beginning of the heating season, which started in November, and we've been polling those folks about their housing situation. I wanted to share a couple of the things with you that they said. 5% of those folks have received terminations of tenancy, and that can vary from their landlord wants to move back into their home, and so they don't want the renters there anymore. They are turning their home into a vacation rental, or they just want to do something different. They want to raise the rents. They, you know, who knows what the reasons are. Approximately 10% of the clients have had rent increases in the last 6 months, and those have ranged anywhere from $50 to $400. One client said that their rent tripled, and I don't have the details on what that means, but that's a scary thought to have your rent triple. And approximately 10% of them identified what sound like fair housing issues to me. I was the former director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, so I'm always interested in what kind of fair housing issues people are encountering.
Peggy, maybe you can mention what that is.
Okay, sure. Violations of the Fair Housing Act, where somebody may experience discrimination based on their race, their religion, their national origin, the fact that they have family with children or a disability perhaps, sexual orientation, marital status, source of income. So it's illegal for a landlord to just say we're not going to take an application from you because you have a housing choice voucher, but we still find that landlords are doing that. We did an advertising survey in our area of all the Craigslist ads for rentals over a period of 3 months, and more than 80% of the ads had verbiage in them that was potentially discriminatory. No animals, no we won't take you if you have Section 8, and so we're very concerned that those things are happening out there and going unreported.
And yet we passed a law that said that they were not allowed to advertise to say no Section 8.
Right. Unfortunately, nobody is supporting the enforcement of that, so it's very difficult. It's a challenging situation. Many of the clients who call are fair housing.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Representative Hurd, question.
Thank you. You referenced no pets. I wasn't aware that that was deemed discriminatory.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Representative Hurd, I said no animals, and so oftentimes it can mean no pets, which is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. But if someone has a service animal or an assistance animal, mm-hmm. They're allowed to ask for a reasonable accommodation, and then the landlord needs to consider whether that reasonable accommodation is allowable. So no pets is often a red flag that they may turn somebody down who has a service animal. Or, I'm sorry, no animals. Many of the clients who call the Fair Housing Hotline that we have talk about habitability issues, repair issues that are pretty serious, but they're afraid to do anything about it. They just want to know what their rights are. They're afraid they're going to lose their housing if they try to get their landlord to do the repairs. It's come to my attention that we have a landlord in Corvallis, for example, that's charging homeless individuals $5 a month to sleep in the crawl space of his commercial building. I mean, just it's amazing the things I hear on the Fair Housing Hotline. For every client that we can assist with housing, we're turning away 15 to 20 because they're struggling to find a place that meets the fair market rent criteria in our housing programs. Those fair market rents, as Michael Bonacorse commented on, are dictated by HUD. So we serve about 200 clients per year with our housing programs, and with the one-time bump that you were kindly generous to give to us in our EHA funds, we're hoping to serve 400 during this year. A few things that our case managers report.
Peggy?
Yes.
EHA.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
Emergency Housing Assistance. Thank you. I'm sorry about
that.
Funny
that the state sends to cities and counties to help with rental assistance.
Thank you for that help, Chair Kinney-Geyer. I wanted to tell you a few things that our case managers reported to me when I told them I was going to come and talk to you, that they wanted you to know that we have many households living in travel trailers with no running water, no plumbing. We have a number of people who we're seeing for the first time because their spouses have passed away and they're unable to retain their housing. Or perhaps there's a divorce. We did also get a couple of really heartwarming stories. One client's husband passed away, and her landlord let her stay in the housing for 6 months for rent-free. That's a very unusual situation. We've also had folks walk into our lobby and say, I'm a former veteran. I have a rental house. I want to help a low-income veteran and offer to put somebody in our program into their rental housing. Those situations are few and far between, but they're still happening out there. And the data gurus that we have at Housing and Community Services and the Housing Alliance have helped me figure out that in our service delivery area, we need approximately 8,000 more affordable housing units to be able to meet the need in our service delivery area. That's a lot. As the Portland market is pushing people into the Salem market is pushing people further out into the rural areas in our market. I don't see that problem stopping anytime soon. The one last piece that I'd like to mention is that we used to be a lot more successful in being able to get our clients on our rental programs into affordable housing units in the private market when we had rent guarantee funds. And when the change was made for those guarantee funds to support folks who were on the Housing Choice Voucher Program, that eliminated that opportunity for just our ordinary rental program folks who are maybe second chance renters, where they may have something derogatory in their rental history, or they may have been had some credit problems, and so landlords don't want to take a chance to rent to them unless they have some sort of rent guarantee. So it'd be wonderful if we can figure out a way to help get that program started up again.
There is a bill.
I know
to
that.
Consider that.
Okay. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions?
All right. Thanks for
inviting me. Thank you so much. Thank you, Peggy. Okay, last we have Jacob Fox, Director of Eugene Housing Authority.
Chair Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, fellow committee members, my name is Jacob Fox. I'm the Executive Director of the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County. We're the second largest housing authority in the state of Oregon, and one of the things that is unique about Lane County is that we get to serve the metro area, which is Eugene and Springfield, but we also serve the rural area. So I get to spend time with mayors, city managers from Oak Ridge, Creswell, Cottage Grove, Florence, etc. And for me, being able to serve both rural and metro area is really a powerful part of my job. So I want to start also by saying that I'm the president of the Oregon Housing Authority Association. We have 22 housing authorities across the state. Many of us have existed since the 1940s and 50s. So we've been quietly and deliberately serving low-income people in our communities for many, many years. One fact for you is that $175 million of Section 8 rent assistance passes through us a year, and the vast majority of that goes out to private landlords in our community. So we're not just serving the poor in our community, we're also part of the economic fabric in our community as well. We have a lot of challenges, but I want to start with some things that are going really well in our community. Our agency has successfully completed 100 units of affordable housing, and we just opened a building in November focused on families, and that's 48 units. And in March, we'll be opening another building that's focused on people coming out of prison. And the idea is to not let those folks reoffend and to not let those folks become homeless, but provide affordable housing and a stepladder for them to better themselves in our community. So there is a lot that's happening, and it would not be possible without your support and without the support of OHCS. Another thing that we're really proud of is that we've graduated 105 people off our programs that have become homeowners. over the last 20 years through our family self-sufficiency program. So we are really actively supporting our families, again, to contribute to our community. So the Section 8 rent increases are significant in our community, and I do have a few statistics for you. In 2015, our Section 8 program received 84 requests for rent increases. The average rent increase was $56, and the highest increase, this is a scarier number, but it was a $366 increase for one family. In 2016, our Section 8 program noted 283 increases, so that's a tripling of the request for increases in our community. The average increase was about the same at $53, and the highest increase was $400. So our real estate market is volatile in our community, and it's definitely a challenge for low-income people in our community.
Yeah, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. Just to clarify, the $300 and the $400 increase, do you know what the rents were prior? Because I've had some people tell me, you know, wow, they raised my rent $400, but they started out at $500, and they'd been on a huge break for a long time.
Yeah, those are just the largest. I would tend to agree with you that those are probably rents that were pretty low, and a landlord maybe changed hands, and they increased it. But I can fact find that and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank
you. Quick question on the vouchers. Is there an annual cost of living increase to the recipients on that, or is it flat and stay the same?
That's a great question. So the way the Section 8 rent calculation works is the person that's on the program pays 30% of their income in rent, so there is no annual fluctuation. But when rent increases happen, we adjust their share of the rent based on that increase.
It might be good for you to describe the Section 8 program, how many people who need Section 8 can get it, the wait list, just a little bit about it, because it's been referenced several times, but we haven't really talked about what it is. So if you can give like a 3-minute summary of the program.
Absolutely. Section 8 is a federally funded rent assistance program. The funds come through the Department of Housing and Urban Development directly out to 3,300 housing authorities across this nation. And the way it works is that the vast majority of the program is what's called tenant-based. So the individuals receive a voucher and they go out into the community and negotiate with a private sector landlord in most cases. In some cases, it's a CDC or nonprofit. Individuals on the program pay 30% of their income in rent, and the premise behind that is that when they pay 30% of their income in rent, they have money to afford things like food and other necessities for their family. As you've seen from statistics, and I have some today, people in many of our communities are paying 50% or 60% percent of their income in rent, and they don't have the funds they need to support their families. So that's
Representative Byrd. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Just a quick question to go back to the larger rent increases you referenced. Yeah. Were those Section 8 tenants?
Yes, they were.
That?
Yeah.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Previously, when I owned a multiplex, I had some Section 8 tenants. And so if memory serves me correct, when I had to apply, when I wanted to increase rent, mm-hmm. I had to give advance notice to Section 8. And it seemed like to me I was capped at basically there's a process of Section 8 looks at the market around me and then determines what is fair, what is not fair. Am I wrong?
I think that's correct, and that gets back to Vice Chair Stark's point that if the rents were really low, then you could see those really large increases.
Final.
Yes, please.
More of a comment. So for the committee, that's just, I think it's important information to understand that, because I'm finding oftentimes that kind of data is half of the data, and it provokes a negative response out of us in the legislature, and I think it's important that we really dig deep on what's really the full picture there to understand, because as Representative Stark pointed out, it could have been a $200 a month special 6-month program put in place by the landlord, and so I don't want us to take it the wrong way. That said, there are people out there that make mean decisions when it comes to the people that it impacts that are renting from them.
Thank you. Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So taking this point into consideration, so we're also seeing just an overall increase in rents throughout. So that sort of fair market value is based on what we're seeing everywhere. So the fair market value is bringing everything up. Is that correct?
That is, yes.
Okay. Follow up to that. I wanted to make sure that people also understood that it's my understanding here, having done this for a little while and working with folks in Section 8, if their personal income increases, also their portion of the rent increases. I wanted to make sure we were clear on that piece, because it isn't just that Section 8 will, you know, increase only when there's a rent increase. That number is going to change and shift as that personal income changes and shifts, and if it goes down significantly.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Thank you.
Thank you.
And one of my understandings about Section 8 is that since you get a limited amount of federal funds, as the rents go up, you have fewer and fewer vouchers to give to people, and then they have 3 months with which to go. And once they get off a wait list, they have 3 months to go and find a rental situation with the amount that they can take. And if they can't find that, they lose their place. Is that correct?
That is correct. At our agency, just says on average, our average HAP subsidy or Section 8 subsidy is about $450 a month. Some more, some less, as you say.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Just one more clarification on the Section 8, because obviously we all know a little bit about it, but trying to get a full picture. The fair market value that the vouchers are based off of, what is the timeline, or when are those numbers generated? Because I remember I met with a handful on that, and it was on old data that they were generating.
3-year lag. Those,
right, which we're not keeping up. So that's is that accurate? It's 3 years?
Yeah, I know Chair Kenny Geyer did some work on this. So, we base what are called our payment standards on what are called fair market rents that HUD distributes. And those are distributed annually. And there is some issues with a lag between the HUD FMRs and what's actually happening in our communities.
And typically that's a 3-year lag, is that correct? Or have they caught up a little?
I think it really depends on the community, but in the Portland metro area, that's my understanding.
I'm looking at Margaret Salazar because she used to be the
local
director of the HUD program back here.
Madam Chair.
So if people have more questions, they can also go to see her. Yes, Representative Hurd.
Thank you. A quick question. Going back to the vice chair brought up about how when a tenant on Section 8 increases their income, the subsidy decreases. What's the rate? If I begin to earn $100 a month more, does my subsidy decrease 100, or is it 50, or what's the formula we base that on?
It's always 30% of your income. So okay. If your rent went up by $100, you'd pay roughly $30 more a month.
No. I'm speaking to the tenant's income, not the rent.
Okay.
Like, as if their salary went up $500 a month,
right,
and then that's going to have an impact to the subsidy. What's the ratio? How's that formula constructed to decrease the subsidy as their income comes up? Was that the 30% again? Or
Yeah.
I'll probably need to see that on paper somehow, because I'm just not putting it together. Right.
I'd be happy to. I'll email you.
Perfect.
Just a kind of a breakdown of how that works.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So did you have any?
Just a couple more.
Yeah. Okay.
You guys have time here. So let's see here. I guess one of the things that I would share too is I was recently in the living room with a family of 7 people that had been homeless throughout last winter, and they had a really tough time as a 7-member family. Finding a place to live, and they had a rent subsidy, a Section 8 rent subsidy. And so we had to do multiple extensions of their voucher in order to help them find a place to live. So the two other things, second to last thing is preservation is a real issue. I've talked a lot about Section 8, but housing authorities also have what are called public housing buildings, and those have a similar rent subsidy, but housing authorities own those. So I just went to a 50 year anniversary of one of those buildings, mm-hmm. and I'm sure committee member Hurd can attest to, as buildings get 50 years old, they experience a lot of challenges. And so the Meyer team talked about preservation of this critical housing, to think of it like infrastructure, like roads and sewers. And I would strongly agree that we have a lot of disabled and elderly people that really need that housing. In closing, I don't want to close with anything with challenges. I want to close with two successes. The emergency housing assistance grant that you all supported in the last session has been an immense help in our community. Two quick examples. The frequent user system engagement, which is identifying the people in your community that are in and out of jail, in and out of the emergency rooms, that are costing your community the most money. In Lane County, we've worked with law enforcement, with the hospitals, and we've identified the 250 people that are costing our community the most money. And we're using EHA funds to reach out directly to those folks and assist them with their housing search. Another quick example is that Lane County and our agency co-funded a landlord liaison position that is working much more deliberately with landlords to grow the number of landlords that we work with, and also educate them about who we serve and how they can become helpful. So on that note, I will close my comments.
Great. Thank you very much. And we got right on time. So I wanted to end with, you know, any general reactions that any of you had. I don't know that we have much time for that, but if anyone wants to just say something. I mean, this was really kind of laying out what the housing needs are and why this is such an important topic. Housing only became a part of this committee. It used to be called the Human Services Committee until 2 years ago. So it's really been given special focus because it is as important as economic development and education and transportation and health and the other kinds of things that we look at. So hopefully this gave you a taste of how dire the situation is and how we need to be really attacking it from every single different angle we can. And so there'll be a lot of focus on, there's no one solution, no one silver bullet, and we don't have a lot of money on the table. And so we're going to just have to be very strategic about where we allocate money, how we do that, how we have public-private partnerships. Amen. So any other comments, final comments on this?
Thank you, Chair Kinyar. I would just hope that as we look at it, as you just said, it's so complex, and it's been, you know, many years in the making, and all mm-hmm. kinds of different factors that work into this. And we have to make sure that as bad as the crisis is right now, mm-hmm. that solutions we look for that are an immediate response, and we don't mm-hmm. neglect the long-term impact of those, whether good or bad. Mm-hmm. And so we have to really look at that we don't compound a problem that's right. in 5 years for a 1 year relief.
That's right. So mm-hmm. we will definitely do that. We'll take short and long-term approach and consequences. Okay, thank you very much. Close the hearing on human services and housing. Close the hearing on human services and housing.